Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we will endeavor to complete the text of Tattvasandarbha, and then we'll run through the test and our idea. My idea actually is to do the test tomorrow. How does that sound? Because I won't be here now on page 83. And we have our last little subsection. This is all to do, of course, with defining the meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam. In this case, in reference to the descriptions given in the Bhagavatam of its 10 topics. And how its 10 topics are addressed and described like that. So yesterday we were discussing how Shukadev Goswami, how he presents the 10 topics. That was in the second canto, chapter 10. Now in the 12th canto, chapter 7, is it? I think it's 7. Yeah, it is. 12th canto, chapter 7, that means right at the end of the book, Suta Goswami also lists out the 10 topics. But actually, at least on the surface of it, he does that a little differently. And we have indicated that by what we've written on the board there. On your left-hand side is the list that we went through yesterday in the order given yesterday by Shukadev Goswami in the second canto. On your right-hand side is, well, actually, I need to, in fact, just change it or add something, in fact, to suttas, because suttas' order is different in some cases, and the names are different in some cases. Yeah, let me just quickly write it on. Here you have the lists. Shukadev, as we discussed yesterday, number one is Sarga. The parallel from Sutta is also Sarga, exactly the same. It's also number one in Sutta's list from the 12th canto. Then, second, also in both cases, is Visarga, the secondary creation. And similarly, third, well, they use different terms. Shukadev says sthanam. He also said sthiti in one of those verses that was following on and just giving some further explanation. He said sthiti vaikunta vijaya. Yeah. So sthanam or sthiti is given by Shukadev as number three, means maintenance or protection like that. And Sutta, though, his number three, which means exactly the same thing, is vritti, V-R with a dot under the R, T-T-I. Then they both have the same, using different terms, though, for number four. Poshana. Shukadev says Poshana is number four, protecting the devotees. Sutta says Raksha. It's just a difference in word, and in both cases it's number four. Shukadev, his number five is Uti, material desires. And Sutta, he uses the word Hetu, but actually it's number nine in his list. Then number six from Shukadev is Manvantara. You know, we would tend to place a little more emphasis on Shukadev's because he is really the celebrated speaker. But actually there's no real difference that we'll see as we go through them. So number six from Shukadev is Manvantara, the lifetimes of the Manus and other rulers and saints even. Sutta calls that Antara, And for him it's number 5 and not number 6. Number 7 from Shukadeva is Ishanukata. Ishanukata means stories about the Lord, about the great devotees. Sutta says his number 6 and number 7 are Vangsa and Vangs Anucharita, which anyway, we'll read about that shortly, very shortly. Vangsa means the dynasties of great kings, and Vangs Anucharita means the activities of those kings. Yeah, one is just descriptive or description of the dynasty. And you see that if you read the Bhagavatam. There are a few chapters, they just list out names. Who was who and who was their son and then who was his children and so on like that. Then Vangs Anucharita, number 7 from Sutta, means the activities of those kings. Then Nirodha, number 8 from Shukadev, means annihilation. So it is also number 8 from Sutta, but it's called Samsta. Then Shukadev's number 9 is Mukti, liberation. That is included within annihilation. It is a particular form of annihilation. When we get to number 6, verse 63, we'll see that very clearly. So that is there. It is kind of featuring as 2. In Sutta's list. Then number 10, of course, from Shukadev is the Ashraya, and Sutta, it's also number 10, but he calls it Apashraya. Means basically the same thing. This list is given by Sridhar Swami in his Bhavarta Dipika. All right. So, we'll start reading 61.1. In the following two verses, Sri Suta Goswami describes in a different way the characteristics of Srimad Bhagavatam that qualify it as a Mahapurana. And in so doing, he affirms that the Supreme Lord alone is the Ashraya. So as we said, this is Srimad Bhagavatam, 12th canto, chapter 7, beginning with verse 9. And again, it's a whole series of verses. First of all, these two verses, 9 and 10, they just list out the 10 topics. Then the following so many verses explain them. And then a final two or three or so verses explain the 10th one, the Apashraya, according to Sutta. So Sutta then says in 12.7, 9 and 10. O Brahman, authorities on the matter understand a Purana, because he means here a Mahapurana, to contain 10 characteristic topics. Sarga, the creation of this universe. Visarga, the subsequent creation of worlds and beings. Vritti, the maintenance of all living beings. Raksha, the sustenance of all living beings. Antarani, the rule of various manus. Vangsa, the dynasties of great kings. Vangs Anucharita, the activities of such kings. Samsta, annihilation. Hetu, motivation. And Apashraya, the supreme shelter. Other scholars state that the great Puranas, the Mahapuranas, deal with these 10 topics, while lesser Puranas may deal with 5. And he explains here the word Antarani refers to periods of manus. 61.2. According to some, a Purana has 5 characteristics. This is now from Matsya Purana, actually. And we already noted this in the first couple of weeks of our course. The 5 characteristics of a Purana are Sarga, creation, Pratisarga, annihilation, Vangsa, genealogy, Manvantarani, the reign of Manus, and Vangs Anucharitam, the activities of dynasties of kings and successions of saints. That is exactly the list which we got earlier. Well, it's coming from exactly the same source, so it's there. This difference of opinion is due to the different topics that characterize greater and lesser Puranas. Although Puranas such as the Vishnu Purana discuss all 10 topics, these Puranas are considered lesser because they discuss only 5 of the topics in depth. These 5. Actually, they do discuss all 10, but the other 5 are only briefly discussed, and actually they are discussed in the context of these 5. And in fact, we will now tell you, although it will not come up in the test, we will tell you how they group them under Saraga in a regular Purana. Under Saraga, creation, comes the Mahapuranas, Saraga, Visarga, and Ashraya. In a lesser Purana, a regular Purana, then when it talks about Saraga, it is talking about Saraga, Visarga, and Ashraya. But more Saraga. And Visarga and Ashraya, they're featuring less prominently and within that context of creation. Pratisaraga, the annihilation. Then, in terms of the topics of a Mahapurana, that is including Nirodha, of course, means annihilation, and Mukti. Mukti is also discussed in the context of annihilation, but as a lesser aspect of annihilation than the regular annihilation of the whole universe being wiped out, like that. Then Vangsa, genealogy, discusses Ishanu Kata, about the dynasties of the great kings, or, well, no, about the appearances of the Lord, the appearances of the Lord in the families of kings. In that sense, it's genealogically related. Then Manvantara, the reign of Manus, that includes Manvantara and Stanam, maintenance. Maintenance is discussed, but as a type of function of the Manus, secondary to the general story of the Manus in general. Then Vangs Anucharita, in a regular Purana, the reign of kings, includes Ishanu Kata. The Lord is appearing in dynasties of kings. Poshana, the protection of devotees. Uti, material desire. And Ashraya. That's just for your interest. We're not going to ask you about that in the test. They're overlapping. In some cases, they're overlapping. Yeah. Because they can be applied. Ashraya can be applied in terms of the Lord's function as the original creator. He is the Ashraya of the living entities, of the material elements. And it also in terms of Vangs Anucharita, the Lord is appearing in the reigns of kings to give Ashraya, but it tends to be secondary to the reigns of the kings and sort of the historical elements of the narrations. Question is, why do Sutta and Shukadeva give different lists? We will be seeing that they are not different. They are causing some different names, but they are meaning the same things. No, it touches there. That's why Shukadeva is so important, because of his touch. Yeah. So, but don't worry, it's not a big thing. It's not a big thing. So, there are other Mahapuranas. Yeah. But those which are not Mahapuranas, then they do discuss them all, as I've just said. But the other ones, the other five, appear as secondary aspects of the five which a regular Purana is focusing on. So now let us go on to 61.3. This is very interesting now. 61.3 to the end of 61. It's very interesting. In Srimad Bhagavatam, there is no intention of discussing the 10 topics consecutively, one per canto. After all, the Bhagavatam has 12 cantos. So, you know, what would the implications be, that two cantos have no position or something? Nor should one think that because the 10 topics are listed in the second canto, right? That we read about yesterday, Shukadeva. He listed them out. That therefore they can be found one after another from canto 3 to 12. Because there's 10 cantos there. Like the two first cantos are introductory somehow and not really dealing with the 10 topics. But then from 3 to 12, they may be dealing with the 10 either consecutively or not. So because the three topics of Nirodha, Mukti and Ashraya can all be found in the 10th, 11th and 12th cantos, nor will one find the remaining topics in order in the other cantos with the exception of the 8th canto. Which would be the 6th if you start at 2. And that would mean that in the 6th canto, you do find Manvantara is focused on very much. Okay. But other things are also, like protection by the Lord. Lord Vamana appears to give protection to Indra, his devotee. So protection is there also. Even though Manvantara is quite prominent in the 8th canto, but it's not the only subject there. 61.4. Srila Sridhar Swami also indicates this, the absence of a strict correspondence between the Bhagavatam's topics and cantos. He says, to spread Lord Krishna's glories, the 10th canto describes how unrighteous rulers suffered annihilation, and he uses the word Nirodha. So in other words, in the 10th canto you find Nirodha. So they suffered their annihilation because they deviated from religious principles. But obviously the 10th canto is also talking about Ashraya, about Krishna. So the four types of annihilations of the total material nature were already described earlier in the Bhagavatam. So here, Sridhar Swami's intention is to show that the 10th canto primarily discusses the Ashraya, the form of Sri Krishna. As Sridhar Swami himself states, the subject of the 10th canto is the 10th topic, the Supreme Lord, who shelters his dependent devotees. We can draw similar conclusions about the other cantos. So that Nirodha then, in the 10th canto, all the demons being killed, so many of them, Nirodha. But actually it's all to serve the glorification of the Ashraya that we talked about yesterday, how these other nine are there simply to glorify, explain about, elucidate about the 10th. So here we have a very clear example of Nirodha in the 10th canto. 61.5. Thus, Sridhar Swami would agree with us that virtually every canto touches on all 10 topics, either directly or indirectly. It is in the same light that we should understand the statement that these topics are described here either directly or indirectly. Now, if you remember, that was Srimad Bhagavatam 2.10.2. We read that yesterday. We noted that point yesterday. In all different ways, in different ways, the 10th topic is being addressed by the other topics like that. Since we actually do find these topics discussed both directly and indirectly throughout the Bhagavatam. And for the same reason, we should recognize that the first and second cantos also belong to this Mahapurana, because they also include the 10 topics very clearly and very wonderfully, like Queen Kunti's prayers in the first canto. Such amazing prayers, very glorious prayers, glorifying Krishna as the Ashraya. So, in the same way, we should understand that the first and second cantos, they're definitely part of Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, we do not accept the idea that these topics are discussed in a strict sequence. Okay, so how's that? That's interesting, isn't it? I found that very interesting. And it's sort of self-evident, really, if you just think about it, and if you read the Bhagavatam, you'll just see that it is happening like that. Sometimes it's more clear, like in the 10th canto, it's just Krishna all the way. In the 8th canto, the Manus and their families are being focused on quite a lot. But, so those are some examples where, one is particularly predominant. But otherwise, on the whole, they're all kind of mixed in together. And they're always just pointing to Krishna. They're always doing that in so many ways, directly and indirectly. Well, that is, yes, Srila Jiva Goswami is not just trying to bewilder us here by producing a doubt that we may never have occurred to us. But the thing is, in those days, there were people who were saying that. Sorry? That mobile living beings generally thrive on immobile ones. But the word cha and in this verse hints that when the desire impels them, moving creatures will also subsist on other moving creatures. For human beings, however, the means of livelihood is prescribed according to their individual natures on the basis of either selfish desire or scriptural injunction. All this is called vritti. This is basically just clarifying the verse. 62.4. In each age, the infallible Lord appears in this world among the animals, human beings, sages, and demigods. By his activities in these incarnations, he protects the universe and kills the enemies of Vedic culture. This is called raksha. So it's exactly the same idea as, what is it, poshana. Yeah. Here the word yai, by them, means by the incarnations. This definition of protection, raksha, also incorporates the three topics, ishakata, narrations about the Supreme Lord, stana, maintenance, and poshana, nourishment. Wow. So, same thing. He's just addressing the same things, but just in different ways. And it's just like, in a sense, different commentators on the Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. It's kind of like that. 62.5. In each reign of Manu, Manvantara, six types of personalities appear as manifestations of Lord Hari. The ruling Manu, the chief demigods, the sons of Manu, Indra, the great sages, and the partial incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Jiva Goswami says, from the mention here of the activities of the Manus and the others, it is understood that the topic of Saddharma, progressive religious principles, is also covered. In this way, this list of 10 topics is equivalent to the one given earlier in the Bhagavatam. Now, Saddharma was an aspect of something. Where was it? Here it is. It's in 57.2. Manvantara. Saddharma. Establishing transcendental religion was included under Manvantara. It's an aspect of Manvantara. But here it's being included. Well, it's also being included. Same. Okay. So even without discussing all 10 topics, he's only discussed a few of them. But we can see how Sutta is addressing the same list of 10. Then dynasties, vamsa, are lines of kings originating with Lord Brahma and extending continuously through past, present, and future. The accounts of such dynasties, especially of their most prominent members, constitute the subject of dynastic history. So, therefore, Jiva Goswami says, the activities of the Vamsadhara, the prominent members of those dynasties, constitutes Vamsanucharitam. So, as we say here in the commentary number 2, even though his list appears different, in some respects at least, from Shukadeva's, it's not different. It's the same list. So then he goes on to discuss the balance. See, already without discussing all 10, he has mentioned at least quite a few of the 10, more than he has actually given from his list. I mean, in terms of Shukadeva's list. So now he's going to cover the balance. And this is the last verse, devotees. This is it. This is the end of Tattvasandarbha. There are 4 types of cosmic annihilations: occasional, elemental, continuous, and ultimate, all of which are affected by the inherent potency of the Supreme Lord. Learned scholars have designated this topic dissolution, samsta, or nirodha, we would say, from Shukadeva. Now, these, you have to know what these 4 types are, okay? For the at the end of the day of Brahma. Elemental, well, the Sanskrit is prakritik, prakritika. It means, It means the end of Brahma's life. It means complete, really. Elemental or complete. Elemental in the sense that all the elements are dissolved again. You know, it all goes back to pradhan. Are you with us? Occasional means the annihilation at the end of Brahma's day. Elemental or complete means at the end of Brahma's life. Continuous, this is an interesting one. There is continuous annihilation. It means the aging process, the general tendency of all material things to deteriorate over a period of time. Number 3, continue. We're in 63.1. Okay. And we're now with the third of the 4 types of annihilations. Continuous means the way time acts, or the result of time acting on all material things. Everything material is continually going through a process of annihilation. And ultimate means liberation. Liberation here is being considered a type of annihilation, because, you know, not only is your material body annihilated, but your whole material life is annihilated. Elemental can also be called complete, and That means the annihilation at the end of the life of Brahma, when the whole material creation goes back to pradan. So in this way, mukti, as we wrote on the board, mukti, number 9 from Shukadev, is a part of samsta, number 8 from Sutta. Because Sutta has not mentioned mukti directly as one of the 10, does not mean he has missed it out. It's there. But in the context of samsta or annihilation, number 8 from Sutta. Jiva Goswami says, in this verse, the word asya, his, refers to the Parameshwar, the Supreme Lord, while swabhavata, due to nature, means by his energy. The term atyantika, ultimate, implies that mukti or liberation is included in this kind of dissolution. 63.2. Now he's going to talk about hetu directly, uti. It's already been included in one of the others to some extent, but now he's going to talk about it directly in the next verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, 12.7.18. Sutta says, out of ignorance, the living being performs material activities and therefore becomes in one sense the cause or hetu of the creation, or uti, you could say, of the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe. If there were no stupid, conditioned souls like us, you wouldn't need a stupid material world. No. One time, there's a conversation. One person is asking Prabhupada, that, what's going to happen, though, if everyone takes to Krishna consciousness and goes back to Godhead? What will happen to the human race? Prabhupada said, yes, this is our goal. No more human race. This is our goal. Yes. No more universe. No more material world. Some authorities call the living being the personality underlying the material creation. So here again is a sort of indirect suggestion that the jiva could possibly be the ashraya. This is going to be addressed, though, shortly. While others say he is the unmanifest self, could be the ashraya, perhaps. So, Jiva Goswami says, the hetu, or cause here, is the nimitta, or efficient cause. Asya, of this, refers to this universe, the existence of which is due to the jivas, who act in ignorance. It's not that Krishna, as the primary cause of creation, it's not that he wants a material world for his own personal purposes at all. It's just for the jivas, who act in ignorance. Some call that same cause the anushayi, the underlying personality, highlighting the principle of consciousness, while others call him the avyakrita, the unmanifest, focusing attention on the jivas, upadis. Because of the upadis, because we're in maya, because we've got upadis, because we're conditioned, limited by our conditioning, therefore the world has been caused. But in another sense, in the anushayi sense, the first of the two senses, then because we are living entities and we are capable of animating matter and supplying consciousness within this material world, therefore, on that level also, we could be called the cause. 63.3. The Supreme Absolute Truth is present. So now, you see, now he's introducing the ashraya, but he's going to call them the apashraya. It means basically the same thing. We'll see as we go through this. The Supreme Absolute Truth is present throughout all the states of awareness, waking consciousness, sleep and deep sleep. Again, the point of Pipalayana. Throughout all the phenomena manifested by the external energy and within the functions of all living entities, and he also exists separate from all these. He's underlying within all of them, but he's also separate. So he's really the real Ashraya. Thus situated in his own transcendence, he is the ultimate and unique shelter. So then Jiva Goswami comments, it cannot be said that the Jiva is the Ashraya, even in his pure state. That would go against what Srila Vyasadeva experienced in trance. Rather, the correct understanding is as follows. And now, this is his explanation of 12.7.19, the verse at the beginning of 63.3, which we are reading right now. 63.3 has pointed out, or this 12.7.19, Suta Goswami has pointed out, how the Jiva, even though he might appear to be the Ashraya in some sense, he can't really be the Ashraya. So the explanation is, based on 12.7.19, the Supreme Brahman is alone in his original identity. He is aloof from the states of consciousness, known as waking awareness and so on, and also from the manifestations of matter, beginning with the Mahatattva. All these are products of the external energy, that is to say, creations of his Maya potency. So he's applying the realization of Vyasa again. While remaining aloof from all these manifestations, he simultaneously associates with them in his features the Supersoul, the Supreme Witness. Therefore, he is the basis for the Jiva's activities in both his pure and his conditioned state. But in this context, the word apashraya indicates that even while he is the foundation for the Jiva's activities, he still remains transcendental to everything. The prefix apa refers to abandonment, which here amounts to the idea of transcending. He's got nothing to do with it, just in case you might have thought that he could have. Doesn't mean that this is a superior concept to simply Ashraya, but there is an element of emphasis by Sutta. 63.4. Such knowledge of the pure nature of the Jiva, who is here designated the cause of material existence, leads to realization of the Apashraya, or transcendental fountainhead of existence. As Suta Goswami states in two verses, which just happen to be the next two verses. So this, of course, is referring to what? 63.2, where there was some suggestion that the living being is the Hetu, either in the sense of being the underlying conscious entity, or because of having his upadis, because he's materially conditioned, therefore he needs a material world. Because someone's a criminal, they need a prison. And the supreme authorities will provide. So in certain senses, like this. So this knowledge then from 63.2, from this previous verse, a couple of verses back, from Suta Goswami, about the Jiva being designated the cause of material existence, it's not meant to confuse us, it's meant to help us understand the Apashraya, actually. As Suta Goswami states in the next two verses, although a material object may assume various forms and names, its essential ingredient is always present as the basis of its existence. Similarly, both conjointly and separately, the Jiva is always present with the created material body throughout its phases of existence, beginning with conception and ending with death. Either on the strength of one's own power of discrimination, or because of one's regulated spiritual practice, See, now he's making here a very important statement. This is actually the concluding statement of the whole book. He's going to explain it further in the next, in 63.5, but here is the statement, concluding statement. So either on the strength of one's power of discrimination, means either by jnana, or because of one's regulated spiritual practice, either through bhakti yoga, one's mind may stop functioning on the material platform of waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Then the jiva understands the supreme soul and withdraws from material endeavor or goes back to Godhead. Yeah. So now he's going to explain that in 63.5. We can consider the substances, earth, water, and so on, to be either associated with their products having names and forms, such as pots, or separate from them. After all, we can identify these substances even apart from their products. You get the idea? You can see trees, which are wood, or you can see these chairs, which are made of wood. In both cases, you know, oh, here we have some wood. So, yeah, so you can consider these fundamental substances either in association with their products or derivatives like that, or in their more original states. In the same way, although by the force of ignorance, the originally pure spirit soul becomes involved with the 9 stages of life from conception to death, he can nonetheless become indifferent by understanding that he is in fact distinct from all this by virtue of his being a pure self. Thus becoming aloof, he is then qualified to inquire about the ashraya. That is the purport of the verse beginning Viramata, which is the last of the verses we just read. So, the 9 stages, again, we're not going to ask you this in the test, but I just thought you might like to know what are these 9 stages. Impregnation, gestation, or is it gest or gest? Huh? Gestation, sorry. Birth, childhood, youth, maturity, middle age, old age, and death. These are the 9 stages. Impregnation, gestation. You know what gestation means? It means development within the womb. Birth, childhood, youth, maturity, middle age, old age, and death. These are the 9 stages. What stage are you in? Somewhere in the middle. Well, I'm somewhere in the middle. I mean, I have to be honest with myself and admit that. Only a couple more to go, folks. Yeah, we're getting there, I'm afraid. Okay, so now Jiva Goswami is going to explain further. The vritti triyam, the 3 functional states, are the states of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. Atmanam, the self here, means the supersoul. Swayam, by oneself, means by carefully studying the illusory nature of the world, as the sage Vamadeva did. He was a jnani. So, if you remember, in the last verse it said that, you know, you may come to the point of withdrawing, of like approaching the Supreme Soul and withdrawing from material life, either on the strength of your power of discrimination or through regulated spiritual practice. So either through jnana or through bhakti, jnana like Vamadeva, or yogena by yoga indicates that one may conduct this study by means of the kind of meditation Srimati Devahuti and others practiced. Well, that's there in the third canto. That means devotional service. Ihaya Nivartate, he becomes free from all actions, means that he refrains from all activities other than the practice of God realization. This is our explanation of Sambandha, the connection between Srimad Bhagavatam and the subject it discusses. How's that? It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Yeah, pretty amazing. And, you know, we've been determining the meaning here in terms of the 10 topics. And you can see they've both done it. Shukadeva and Sutta. They've both done the same thing. Led us through all these 10 topics and brought us to this point of surrendering to Krishna. Here, of course, he's not being so absolutely to the point of saying, yes, it's Krishna. Ede changsa kalapum sa Krishna stu Bhagavan swayam. He's saying it's to the super soul. But the super soul is just part of Krishna. That has already been established very clearly. And, you know, pointing out Krishna, identifying Krishna specifically, is going to come in later Sandarbhas. Yeah. Although effectively he has done it, actually. Effectively he has done it. No, its subject is Krishna. So the connection is, how does it present Krishna? It's like that. That's the connection. It could say many things about Krishna. But what does it say? It says no. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it says we should surrender to Krishna. Yeah, like this. It discusses the 10 topics. It discusses the other 9 in terms of their how they relate with Krishna. This is how it discusses the subject. Doesn't just discuss the Leela, you know, it's an analytical discussion of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and our relationship with him like this. So 63.6, thus ends the Tattva Sandarbha, the first book of the Bhagavat Sandarbha, which was written according to the instructions of Srila Rupa Goswami and Srila Sanatana Goswami, the revered leaders of the Universal Royal Assembly of Vaishnavas. They are unalloyed servants of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the purifier of the jivas in Kali Yuga, who descended to distribute the benediction of his own devotional service. So that is the end of Tattva Sandarbha, concluding with some nice words of glorification, humble offering of praise and taking shelter like that of his superiors. And I must say, I've enjoyed presenting this course very much. You've been a very nice group of students.